Thank you, Mr. Parker, and happy Sabbath to everyone. Good to see all of you. Today, we're going to, for the sermon, we're going to be having a PowerPoint presentation. You can say, well, man, he's on the PowerPoint fixation here. Well, you know how it is. You kind of get into it, and you start using it, and then we'll stop. But for the time being, we're going to use it, and I felt it would be helpful to you. And so we'll take a look at this today, the subject that I'm talking about is a subject that harkens us back to the 1990s when the issue was a challenge to church members. Yeah, those of you who were around the church at that particular time, it was a very challenging time as we were questioned on the subject of the law. So we spent a lot of time on the law. That was in 1995, and gave a lot of sermons on that and Bible studies and answered questions. So it's not that the law is not important, but it's something that, like a cycle, it goes through, and then it eventually comes back to the fore again, and it's important to analyze it. So we're going to take a look at the law, and we're going to take a look at it from God's perspective to begin with. But there's plenty more that we can discuss about the law, and we will from time to time. Next week we're not going to hit the law again. We're going to talk about getting the most from church services. So we'll talk about that next week, and hopefully that will be helpful to you. So we'll venture into that subject. How do you get the most from services make the most of your opportunity to gather together with God's people? So the beginning premise of my presentation today is God's law is eternal. God's law is eternal. God's law the statement there, God's law is eternal, is important because it tells you the origin of the law. It begins with God. God is the creator of the law and the one who passed along the law to mankind. And we'll see that God did even more than that as he shared the law with others and especially all of us. As we look at the subject of the law, we'll look at, is the law done away? We'll look at what is the law of Christ? Because people come up with all these variations to prove that the law is no longer applicable. So we'll try to understand that. So as I said, the law derives from God, we might ask, when did the law begin? Well, because God exists, the law began with God. I mean, God has existed forever, therefore God's law is eternal. It's been around forever. It's just a reflection of God's quality of character and is something that we can reason from as we think about God's law. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 57, verse 15. This has become one of my favorite verses as far as dealing with God, and it tells us so much about God and expresses it in a unique way that I find to be quite helpful. Isaiah chapter 57, verse 15. And it says in that verse, "For thus says the high and lofty one, that is God, who inhabits eternity." So God dwells in eternity. We can read that and think, well, what's the big deal with that? Well, we have to stop and think about what is eternity. And God dwells there. And God dwells there, and the one who became Jesus Christ dwells there as well. And they've always dwelled there and will dwell there, except in those times where Christ came to the earth and was a man and was bound in that particular way. But usually God is without bounds, and God dwells in eternity. It says, "whose name is holy." He says, "I dwell in the high and holy place with him who has a contrite and humble spirit." So God says, who do I dwell with as far as humanity is concerned? He says, I dwell with the contrite, I dwell with the humble in spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the heart of the contrite ones. So I spend time with them. These are the people that have access to my throne because of they come to me in humility, and I dwell in eternity, and I give them, based upon their humble approach, the opportunity to dwell with me. So it means that we may live here on this earth. We're physical human beings. We're bound by the physical world. But God says you can have access to me and have a relationship with me that can continue throughout your life as a physical person, but it can be something that will go on into eternity. So God is eternal and dwells in eternity. In Hebrews chapter 7, verse 3, it tells us something about the one we know as the Logos, or the one who became Jesus Christ, and it tells us something about God's eternity. It says in that verse, chapter 7, verse 3, it says that Jesus Christ, without father, without mother, without genealogy, so God has no origin like a human being. So he has no end. He was not created. He did not come from the womb of a woman. He exists, and Jesus Christ was in that very state, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains a priest continually. So Jesus Christ is God, our high priest. He sits at God's right hand and serves us on a continual basis as our high priest. He had no beginning, he had no end, and he will continue on throughout eternity. And he has particular roles that he completes. For instance, he came as a man and lived in the flesh, and then he, as he died and rose the third day, then he returned to heaven and sits now at God's right hand. And as far as eternity is concerned, I picked this particular image of figure eight because it has no beginning and end, nor end. That's why somebody came up with that concept, this figure eight, no beginning, no end. So it kind of gives you man's thoughts about eternity. It's incomplete because still, if you conceive of God this way, God is still bound. And God has no bounds, and you can't bind him in any way. It's just a way that you can try to express God. So the next point is that God sets the bounds or limits in all things. So God is the one who set bounds, and he set bounds for everything. And one way that he laid it out was to Job, who had a relationship with God. And Job got a little carried away with about himself and about his relationship with God. And so God finally, and Job, he was suffering, and Job wanted God to bring him before his throne and to ask him, ask God, well, why are you treating me this way? This isn't fair. And so God said, okay, here's your opportunity to come before my throne. And you have the opportunity to make your case. But God had a few comments to make before he let Job make his case. And beginning in Job 38, verse 4, it says, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Job wasn't around, and neither were any of us. We're still trying to figure out the foundation of the earth and to figure out things about the origin of the earth. And he says to Job, tell me if you have understanding. And once God started confronting him, he didn't have understanding. He didn't know what to say because they were questions that were way beyond Job's ability to answer. And if we were asked such questions, we wouldn't be able to answer them either. Verse 3, who determined its measurements, surely you know, or who stretched the line upon it. So God, just like measuring for a project or measuring for a building, measured it all out. And he's asking me about the measurements, about the line that was laid to them to create them. And then he says, to what were its foundations fastened? So, you know, usually if you have a foundation, it's attached to something. you know, it's built on the bedrock, or it's in a certain way that you can determine, but how do you determine this for the universe as a whole? Or or laid its cornerstone. You know, as you lay build a building, you have a cornerstone, which is a fundamental part of that building. Well, what do you know about the cornerstone? When was it laid? How was it laid? How does it continue to be in place in order to hold everything together? It says in verse 7, when the morning stars sang together, well, the morning stars are the angels, and the angels were aware of all of this. They were around when all of this was taking place, and they saw it all take place, which means if they saw it, means that they were created prior to the physical creation. And all the sons of God shouted for joy because it was such a magnificent creation that God brought about. And, or why shut the sea with doors? What when it burst forth and issued from the womb? And you have, you know, when God created the waters, you know, water, if you deal with it, is something that once you, if you release it, it's going to flow someplace. That's how it always works. You know, if you're a plumber, you know that water flows downhill, and it flows until it butts up against something that's going to stop it. And God is talking about water in this particular way, that it's going to flow until it reaches something that stops it. And God is the one who set the bounds. God is the one who set the limits for it. He says in verse 9, when I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling hand, when I fixed my limit for it and set hers and set bars and doors. So anyway, I can't even read my own printing. So God set the limits on all of these things, and God established them and fixed the limits. And he says in verse 11, when I said, this far you may come, but no further, and here your proud waves must stop. So if you look at an ocean, it's always flowing back and forth, out and in. And God said, I control all of this. I start it, I stop it, and I'm in complete control of everything. So God sets the limits on the physical world, and even though God is infinite and without beginning or end, God's creation has boundaries and limits, which we all know from our personal experience. And we have these limits that are placed on the world that we all have to experience. When we think of the angelic realm, the angels also had limits on them as well. They were created by God, and God brought them into being. And as he brought them into being, he placed limits on them. Now, limits weren't a problem until the angels chose to go their own way. And so we see three passages here which deal with Satan's rebellion and the point in time when they decided, we're going to go our own way, we're going to do what we want. And God created them. And he wanted them to go in a certain path, just like he wanted Adam and Eve to go in a path that was righteous. But unfortunately, that's not the path that they went on. Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 12, describes the angelic host and Satan especially. It says, you were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. So when Satan was created, before he became Satan, he was perfect in every way. He was full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. So he had everything going for him. God created him that way. And then in chapter 28, verse 14, it says, you were the anointed cherub who covers. You were chosen for a special responsibility. You were anointed. I anointed you and placed you in that responsibility. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created. So God created this angelic being that we know today as Satan. He was perfect. And he was perfect until the day he decided, I'm not worried about being perfect anymore. I'm going to pursue my own course. So you may be created perfect, but if you decide I'm going to go my own way and defy God, which is exactly what Satan did, then you're no longer perfect. Because God says you were perfect until the day, from the day you were created till iniquity or sin was found in you. So Satan decided he no longer wanted to be under God's power and control, and he was going to go his own way because he objected to what God was going to had in store for the angels. So he decided we're going to topple God from his throne. And that's talked about in Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah chapter 14 gives us more of the story, beginning in verse 12. It says, "How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning." So Satan and the demons decided that they would rebel against God and that they would topple God from his throne. And so they rose in rebellion against God. And their goal was to defeat God, to destroy God, to kill God if they could. "For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farther sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High." Basically, I'm going to replace God. I will take over the rule of the universe. And God said, no, we're not going to go down that path. And Satan and those people who followed him were defeated. And so we see that God had clear boundaries or laws that governed the spiritual realm. The angels were free moral agents, able to choose the way they wanted to go. And a portion of them listened to Satan and decided, we're going to follow him. Like in Revelation, it tells us a third of them followed him. They were going to follow him in rebellion against God. But we're in, so we see that they overstep their bounds. Now, as you look at this, you know, God sets the bounds. And as you think about it, do we see 10 commandments for angels? You can't find any place in there that lists 10 commandments for angels. But you can obviously see that there were bounds that God placed upon the angels. He said, you can't go beyond this limit. And here's where you can live. You can live inside of this, but don't go beyond it. But Satan didn't like that box that God had placed them in, and so he led the angels in rebellion against God. But God had set up limits. And it's interesting that when God defeated them, then he put them into a box again. The Bible calls it into its Tartaru, mentioned in Peter. You know, there it's a limited space in which they can live. So they live within that limited space, and they're not to come out of there and until God says it's time. And there will be a time when he gives them more space than they have now. So then God went on to create the physical universe. And in the beginning, as it says, God created the heavens and the earth. He created everything and brought it all into being. So God created the heavens and the earth, and all the creation came into being along with the physical laws that govern the physical world. And so we see the evidence of the physical laws that exist because we have the earth spins on its axis, the earth spins, orbits the sun, the earth has the moon orbiting around it. All of these things exist, and God made them and put them into place, and they operate it within laws that govern them. So we have, you know, as we look at the earth and the sun and the moon and the stars, there are laws that govern all of these things. And laws governing the seas and the fresh water, laws governing the plant life, laws governing every aspect of life, animal life, laws governing every aspect of the created order. And as you look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, it speaks of a condition called tohu and bohu, which is basically chaos and confusion. Now, why was the earth in that particular condition? God didn't create it that way. It is in confusion and chaos for a particular reason, because Satan and the demons rebelled against God. And when they began to live in a lawless way, and that lawless approach produced chaos and confusion, created the earth in that condition you find in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. And while that was a long time in the past, that condition is not impossible to once again attain if we follow the lawless path. But God said, we're not going to follow the lawless path. And he bound the Satan and the demons, and he created the heavens and the earth once again, recreated them, and created all of the things that exist on this earth along with mankind. Created the first man and the first woman and placed them on the earth. And God continued on with his great purpose for man. So we think about man, and it talks about man beginning in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. And it tells us that man was created in God's image, created in God's image according to the likeness of God. So in a sense, from a physical, just shape and form, we look like God. God looks like us. We look like God. That's not the whole story. There's a lot more to it. But at least on that basic level, we look like God. And God has also given us the ability to think and to reason and to plan, which is exactly what God does and allows us to do the same thing. So in verse 26, it says that they are to have dominion over the earth. What does it mean to have dominion? It means to rule. So God created man to rule the earth. And that's his purpose for existing. It is to rule. And he says that they're to rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. Now, just because man has rule over all of those physical creatures doesn't mean that he should abuse them, misuse them, basically destroy vast numbers of them. That's not what God meant by dominion. He meant that you would take care of them, that you would take care of the all of the different creatures, and you would make sure that the environment in which they lived was the best for them and the best for you. So God was perfectly happy for them to hunt and to take elk or buffalo or whatever it may be for the table. But God didn't mean for you to go out and kill thousands of them in a few days, shooting them one after another. For what purpose? For hides and all of that. That's not what God intended. But unfortunately, man was given dominion, but man has not always understood what that meant. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. So God established rules governing filling the earth and subduing it. So he was to fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea and over all the other creatures. So God established mankind, and he said, you are to rule, and here are the guidelines for you to rule. They're general guidelines, but they're still guidelines that you're to live by, live in harmony with, because that's what's going to be best for the earth. So I know that, as you look at, I was reading a book before I went to Montana for the feast, and was talking about the Great Plains and what a magnificent part of the United States it was. And I'd really never stopped and thought about the vast herds of buffalo and all of that inhabited the central part of our country. And what a magnificent thing all of this prairie grass was. We went to Seaborn Park in Rosenberg this week, and the kids rode bikes, and I walked around, and the one part of the park, they've tried to reinstate a portion of the prairie. Well, it's just a little tiny piece of prairie, but you can still get an idea and imagine what it would be like to look out for mile upon mile as the undulating hills with all this grass on it, with huge herds of buffalo running around. Someday maybe we'll actually have that as part of the earth. But that's the way God created it and intended it. And he did not mean for us to deforest everything and basically do things that are hurting the earth. And not that the earth is a living thing, but there's a way to use it in a way that is in conformity with the rules that God set up. And as we do that, then we get the greatest benefit from it, and we can enjoy it and pass it along to generations to come. So we go on here thinking about mankind. And in Genesis chapter 2, verse 9, it says, "The tree of life was also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil." So God didn't just set up physical laws that govern things. He also set up spiritual laws, which he's beginning to talk about now, where he talks about these two trees that were in the garden. And so the first one was the tree of life, and a second tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And both of them were in the midst of the garden that God had created. Chapter 2, verse 15. "Then the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, 'Of every tree of the garden you may eat freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. And in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die.'" So God set a limit on which trees man could eat from. So he created this garden, and it was filled with trees that man could eat from. But there was one tree said, "You can't eat of this tree. And in the day that you eat of that tree, you will surely die. You may not keel over and die right there, but at the end of your life, you will be held accountable for eating of that particular tree." So God set a limit on what man could eat. I mean, everything was wide open for eating except this one particular tree. But amazingly, man was aware of that, and man did eat of that particular tree. And what happened? Then God said, "You will die." He kicked him out of the garden and said, "You will die." And so that was something that God laid out. If you eat of this, which is defiance of God, you have sinned against God, and you will die. Now, is that something that just happened as part of the Garden of Eden? Or is this something that comes on down to New Testament times and is remarked upon by the Apostle Paul? In Romans chapter 6, verse 23, the Apostle Paul was very aware of this particular law, and he says in Romans 6, verse 23, it says, "For the wages of sin is death." The wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus our Lord. So I want you to have eternal life, but I want you to live the way that I've asked you to live. And we're not going to get into how we're reconciled to God and all of those kinds of things, but that was God's original intent. Eat of the tree of life, eat of all the trees in the garden, but stay away from this particular tree. That's all I ask of you, which seems pretty simple, but for some reason, man's carnal nature couldn't live within those bounds. And as you think about, as it says there in 1 John 3, verse 4, in the King James Version, it says, "Sin is the transgression of the law." And the Contemporary English Version says, "Everyone who sins breaks God's law." So sin is the breaking of God's law, because sin is the same as breaking God's law. So if we sin, we are breaking God's law, and there is a penalty for it, which is laid out right at the very beginning of man's creation. So God laid it all out for them so they would understand what the penalty would be if they ate of that tree. They did. They suffered the penalty, and we still suffer the penalty to this day. Now, as I've said, the law derives from God, and it is a reflection of his character. So God lives a certain way thinks a certain way, speaks a certain way, and that is reflected in his law. That is reflected in his law. And you may think of God in eternity. Did God need a law? Did God need the Ten Commandments on a couple of pieces of stone or on a wood carving in order to keep track of it? He didn't, because the law is just part of his character, part of the way he is and the way that he functions and the way that he deals with mankind, the way that he deals with the one who sits next to him on the throne of heaven. That's how he deals with them, based upon this law. And the tree of life represents God's law, which is to apply to Adam and Eve and to all of human beings, not just people that live in the garden, but all people in all times. And as you look at the law that flows from God, it's not man's law, it's not Israel's law, it's not an Old Testament law, it's not a New Testament law. The law was established by God and applies to all people at all times. So even though we live in an age where people don't think God's law is applicable at all, the Bible has no relevance to our lives, it very much does have relevance. So people, we see the world in the chaotic state that it's in because people have said, I don't need to keep God's law. I don't want to keep God's law. I want to do what I want to do. And that's exactly what people are doing. I know as you think about that particular concept, you know, a song that's fairly famous is, I'm free to do what I want. And that's a pretty popular point of view. I'm free to do what I want. Well, you are free, but not to do anything you want. God has set up boundaries. And he set up boundaries because if you stay within those boundaries, you will get the positive results. If you decide to venture outside of those boundaries, there are consequences. There are things that come your way that make life more difficult. So God says, don't go outside of those things. And so the scriptures basically talk about law from beginning to end. And we're just going to focus on one place where the law is mentioned, and that's in Psalm 119. And we're not going to spend a huge amount of time going through this particular psalm, which is very long, but we are going to look at a few passages from Psalm 119. Because as you think about the law, it is a wonderful resource to go to and think about what is being said there. Psalm 119 serves as basically a good preface to what we're going to talk about when it comes to the law. As you think about the specific words that are used in regard to the law, they're called testimonies. They're called precepts, statutes, commandments, ordinances, ways, and words. All of those things are applied to God's law. Psalm 119 is a collection of meditations on the excellency of the word, or the law of God. And they talks about it from different angles, and it's an interesting study because it goes through all the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, and under each letter of the alphabet, it discusses different aspects of God's law. And Psalm 119 shows us the glory and eternity of God's law. And so I'd like to just pull out a few verses from that psalm and discuss them now between now and the end of the sermon. So we're not going to go through all of them, but we'll go through some of them and note some highlights here and what they point us to. In Psalm 119, beginning in verse 97, it says, oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day. So what does that mean? It's something that the writer of this particular psalm loves, and he said that it is my meditation. I love it, so I spend my day thinking about it. It fills my mind. It's not something that I read over and then move on and never think about it again. It's my meditation all the day. So as we think about God's law, is it something that we think about with regularity? Is it something that we love and we think about, we meditate on it? And it goes on to say, you through your commandments make me wiser than my enemies, for they are ever with me. So what is he telling us there? He's saying that the law of God makes me wiser than people in general. Because they don't know anything about God's law, and usually they're not applying those principles, but I have them, I think about them, I love them, and as a result of that, I think about them throughout the day. And my enemies aren't thinking about those things, they're not thinking along those lines. But because I have been given insight into God's laws, I think about them, and as I deal with life, as I deal with my job, as I deal with my spouse, as I deal with my children, every aspect of my life, I seek to try to think about God's law and apply it in all of those contexts. Because as I do, the results are good. If I don't, the results aren't so good. So he's saying that I have been given these things. I have more understanding than all my teachers, for your testimonies are my meditation. So I have people that teach me, people that are really, really smart. People that don't spend any time thinking about God's law, but they're really, really smart. They can build a house. They can build a car. They can fix a car. They can do all sorts of things. But do they spend any time thinking about God's law? In most cases, they don't. And as a result of that, they don't have that insight, that understanding, which is crucial to how to live. You know, so as you think about whatever job you have, is there a way that you would approach that job in that would be within the bounds of God's law and that would allow you to please God and your employer and those people you are serving? So, you know, let's say that you're a mailman. So you deliver the mail and you're thinking, you know, I hate doing this. I'm tired of doing this. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take the mail I have, and I'm going to just dump it down the sewer. People do that. So I'm going to dump it down the sewer and go on about my business. Are you done already? Yeah, I finished. So, you know, people do these kinds of things, but, you know, it usually comes back to haunt you. And people have maybe been waiting on their mail, and as a result of what you've done, they're not going to get it. But it's something that we think about in the way that we live. We think about, I'm serving these people. You know, and whatever you do, you say, I'm serving these people, and I want to do the best job that I can, whether it's painting, whether it's doing lawn care, whatever it may be, I want to do the best I can because I'm God's representative. I'm God's representative, so when they see me, I carry the label Christian, so when they see me, this is a Christian. This is how a Christian should act. And you want to do things that reinforce that particular point. He said, I understand more than the ancients. You know, as you think about the ancients like Socrates and Plato, these people that were really, really smart, but they only had limited understanding. It was all bound in their mind. They didn't fully understand everything, and they could not see the spiritual truths. But because God has given you insight, you excel Socrates or Plato or Pascal or any of these other geniuses that are really, really smart. Now, if you put me up against Pascal with math, Pascal's going to excel me. But hopefully, if we're talking about applying God's law, I may not be able to do the equation, but I can try to apply what God wants me to. And if you can do that, it doesn't matter if you can solve math equations or not, you're going to excel Pascal or any other mathematician because of the truths that you have that you're operating by. Now, if you are like Pascal and have great mathematical understanding and understanding of God's law, that's the best ever. So we want to have understanding of the physical world and the spiritual world as well. And finally, he says, I have restrained my feet from every evil way that I may keep your word. So I realize that there's a path that I shouldn't go down. And I try to restrain my feet. I'm not going down that path. I'm not going to act that way or say that. And I know that's hard, but it's something God wants us to strive for. Psalm 119, verses 104, it says, through your precepts I get understanding, therefore I hate every false way. So we gain understanding and we can see that there's a way that doesn't work, a way that we really don't want to pursue because the outcome is going to be negative. It's a false way. So we don't want to go follow that path. And God's law gives us insight which path to follow. The next passage begins in 111. Your testimonies I have taken as a heritage forever, for they are the rejoicing of my heart. I have inclined my heart to perform your statutes forever to the end, the very end. I hate the double-minded, but I love your law. So, you know, we have the truths of God, and it is our heritage, and hopefully we pass it along to our children and help them to understand it and see why it's something that they should follow. We follow it. We want them to follow it. Why? Because of the positive results that they're going to get. And we want to perform those statutes. That means to live by them. Going on in Psalm 119 to verse 115, it says, depart from me, you evildoers, for I will keep the commandments of God. So that's telling us that, you know, there's a path that you can follow, and it says, you know, we all come into contact with people that are up to no good, and it says, don't follow them. Don't go along with them. And instead of following along with them, I'm going to follow the path that I know is right, and that's the path that God has laid out in his word. Psalm 119, verse 26, for it is time for you to act, O Lord, for they have regarded your law as void. And I think this is especially an especially applicable verse to the world in which we live in, where people don't think the law has any application to the world in which we live here in the 21st century. They look upon your law as void, as having no meaning, as having no purpose, having no application to their lives right here and now. And people have come up with wonderful ideas like defund the police, and that the ramifications of that particular issue are being manifest even as we go through life. There's a consequence to that. Not that the police are perfect, but you know what? When the people know that they shouldn't be doing this and that they could get caught, that tends to deter people. It always did me. You know, Gary, if I find that you've stuck in your hand in that cookie jar and I have less cookies when I get home than when I left, there will be consequences. Oops. So basically, I'd like the cookie, but I also realize too big a price to pay. So I'll just wait it out. And I'll be a good boy, and hopefully I'll get more cookies as a result of being a good boy. But I mean, that's where people look and they see if there are no consequences, then I'm going to push the envelope. And so it's not what God intended, And God intended for the law to be a guide for people to live by and stay within because of the positive results in society. Nobody enjoys having their goods stolen. If you've ever had it happen, it's a feeling like you've been violated. I remember the first time that I had something stolen was when we were living in Texas and in Dallas, and I had a nice yellow bike, and one day it was there, and another day it was gone. Where did it go? I don't know, but it wasn't in my garage anymore. But that's the world you live in. You feel violated that somebody just, I shouldn't have had my garage open, but that was the consequence. So we have to, God established boundaries because it brings about the best results for everyone. Psalm 119, verse 127. It says, "Therefore I love your commandments more than gold, yes, than fine gold." And if you look at the issue of gold today, gold is something that a lot of people are turning to because of the inflation and the instability that exists in our economic markets. So they're purchasing gold and storing it or hoarding it or investing in it. But like the psalmist says here, in actuality, what's described in God's law is of more value than gold. Now, if I offered you gold or what's mentioned in Psalm 119, which would you take? A lot of people would take the gold because we're just talking about words and all of that, and they don't see beyond it. But God's telling us that his truths and his law are all more valuable than gold, and when it's all said and done, then if you have God's law and you're living by it, you'll have something to hold on to that can't be taken from you. Whereas if you have gold, it can be taken from you. And it says in verse 128, "Therefore all your precepts concerning all things I consider to be right, and I hate every false way." And then verse 138, it says, "Your testimonies, which you have commanded, are righteous and very faithful." There's something that I can trust and that I can rely upon. Let's go to Psalm 119, verse 160. It says, this particular psalm says, "The entirety of your word is truth." It's truth. It's truth that we can rely on, and every one of your righteous judgments endures forever. It's always there. It will always last. It never rusts. It never goes out of style. It's always there. And it is God's truth. And we want to base our lives on truth. "And every one of your righteous judgments endures forever." They're part of the world in which we live now, if we're willing to follow them, and they most assuredly will be part of the world to come as Christ returns and he establishes the truth and establishes his law, and we begin to see the results of it. So do God, as you think about this and you hear people tell you that the law is done away with, it has no application to our everyday lives any longer, as you look at what Psalm 119, as just one example, tells us, does it seem like God's laws, his precepts, his word, and truth sound temporary or changeable or something that's not going to last? Now, that may be because of the way man looks at it and the way man applies it, and man doesn't see any reason for it. But trust me, if you look at the world and the problems that exist, all of them trace back to the violation of God's laws. And the situation is not going to improve until people say, you know what? God's way is the way to go. And as we do, as mankind follows that path, it's going to make a massive difference that's going to allow the world to really reach its potential. So all of these items have in common the assumption that God gives the law in a way that people can order their lives by. I can live by it, you can live by it, you can live by it in the United States, in Russia, in China, whatever country you go to, you can order your lives by it as a result of being male or female, an adult or a child, it doesn't matter. It applies to everyone in all situations. And it is something that brings about the best things in life. And God's law is eternal and will bring eternal benefits. As you think about it, it's like walking down a path that you can be certain of, and the end of that path and following it is going to bring nothing but good results. So that's all I have to say, but I'd just like to recommend the following study done by Rex Sexton. Rex Sexton is going through Psalm 119 and Bible study by Bible study. He's going through one section of it at a time, and it's very, very helpful. It's detailed, and I think you'll benefit from it. So if you would be interested in just making a recommendation, if you'd be interested in looking at it, you can find it online on YouTube. So if you open up YouTube on your computer and go to YouTube, and if you type in the United Church of God Portland, then it'll take you to where the different presentations are made, and you can even subscribe to it. Nobody has to do that, but you can. And then you can find the different presentations that have been made there, along, not just Mr. Sexton's presentations, but others. And then you can go through it, and I think you'll gain a great deal from it, just going through it and looking at the various things that he brings out in more detail than I can go through. My point was to point out in general terms that God's law is something that is essential to life. And unfortunately, it's not the path that we're following, and there are consequences to it which we see playing out before us. So I hope, and one of the challenges that I see coming is that we were challenged in the law in the past, and God's people have been challenged on the law throughout history. And we're going to have that challenge coming again. I can't say exactly when and how intense it will be, but all of us need to be familiar with God's law so that when it comes, we know the answer. So when somebody tells you the law is done away with, can you answer it? And that was the challenge we found back in 1995, and we went through a lot of things to try to understand it and answer those questions, and hopefully you can take the time now to do that, and we'll go through some of them as in Bible studies and different things as we go forward. So right now it is about 10 after 1, so we'll pick up with the Bible study about 25 till 3, and so enjoy the break. We'll have one more song, closing prayer, and then we'll come back about somewhere between 5. What's that? 3:08. Yeah, it's right. Yeah, and so we'll come back in about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, and have Bible study. So those of you who are able to stay, we look forward to your staying. And a suggestion was made today, maybe you could all move up so that as you're answering the questions we're going to go through, that the guys will not have to run quite as far to get to your answering. So if you would, it would be appreciated.